Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a August 13, 2010 segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. We have a repeat guest with us this evening, namely Jacob Wall. And Jake, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome to the program. Last time we spoke, you were attending an alternative energy conference in your home state of Idaho. Is that not right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Well, now we have a very interesting news flash to share with the public that has been widely publicized about, a year ago? A little over a year ago, there was a MSNBC Dateline segment on the FTC case against Dennis Lee, Dutchman Enterprises, and the HAFC, Hydrogen Assist Fuel Cell. How is it that you've come to be embroiled in a resurrection of that court case against Mr. Lee?
Well, about 3 weeks ago, I got a call from Dennis, and we had several conversations, and their case has been reorganized. I think that the first case about a year ago was a hearing, which Dennis won, and then according to Dennis, for some reason, something happened with the way the court case was documented, and the FTC wasn't able to appeal, and so it was, for some reason, I don't know all the details, but it's actually gone to a full trial, kind of redoing the whole thing.
Yeah, what would seem to me to be a case of like double jeopardy or something, where you can't try a person twice on the same charge.
I don't know the whole details. I know that he said that the first case was a hearing, and this is an actual trial. So I don't know all the legal stuff. But I've been asked to respond to a professor, John Haywood, who's a professor at MIT, who's written an expert witness paper, basically. You know, in opposition to the HAFC and the whole hydrogen from electrolysis to improve combustion technology. So I've basically written my version, a review paper of the things that I've researched, basically saying that that there's data that shows that it does work.
And included in this data is a more recent study that you've just discovered, isn't that so?
Yeah, actually, I've just found a study that was published in July of this year, and it's a university in Turkey, and they've tested a HHO unit. They even says hydroxy-HHO in the title of the paper, and they tested it powered by the engine on a diesel engine, and they found that they were able to achieve about a 20% gain in fuel economy. Let me find the actual number that they state here real quick. Said the system provided an average increase in torque of 19.1%, and it found a specific fuel consumption an average increase of about 14%. And this is an exact opposite of what conventional wisdom would say, that it's not possible. And this paper was published in the International Journal of Hydrogen Energy. So there's that paper, and then there's several others that I have that I show it does work. There's another paper out of Australia, effective H2O2 addition to increase thermal efficiency in diesel engine. And this paper, you know, had similar results.
Yeah, so isn't it interesting that I'm looking at this patent from April 9th of 1918 by C.H. Fraser. It's patent number 1,262,034. And it's an American patent, a U.S. patent, that is titled Hydro-Oxygen Generator. And you wonder, why is it that an American academic at MIT, right?
Right.
Why is it that he's denying the validity of what this patent from 90 years ago claims? or 100 well, years.
More
well, yeah,
than just a, he's more than just an academic. He's basically written a book on internal combustion engines. I mean,
right, but somehow he omitted the work of Charles Fraser in his book.
Right.
So it is possible for someone to consider the subject of internal combustion engines upside down and over and over again and omit very important information that has to do with increasing efficiency and decreasing pollution. I mean, the aspect of water injection by itself, which is a byproduct of using an onboard electrolyzer, that's omitted also.
Right.
And so it makes you wonder, why is it that a university in Turkey and a university in Australia have to come out with a paper substantiating the claim that was made in 1918 by an American who said that an hydrooxygen generator, as he called it, he said it was an effective way of boosting an internal combustion engine.
Right.
Why are we, 90 years later, continuing to debate this?
Well, I've found, what I concluded in my paper is that you get a certain result if you use a compressed hydrogen. There's a series of there's many papers where they use compressed hydrogen from a tank to improve combustion. That's well established. Then there's several.
And that would be similar to using compressed nitrous oxide.
I don't know if it's exactly the same, but.
No, but I mean,
it's
in theory, you could take a tank of nitrous oxide, and many people do, and boost the race car with it, right?
Right, right. And so that's well established. The results vary as far as how much you need and the different engine conditions. Then there's several papers, and these are the papers that Professor Haywood uses to, refute the claims. And basically, they tried to simulate electrolysis products. And so these series of studies, what they did was they took a tank of 97% air and put 1% oxygen and 2% hydrogen. And that mixture was used as the sole input of air to the engine. There was no outside air. It was used direct. The only air intake was from what was used from that tank. And that was assumed to be the same as using an electrolyzer. And one of the key components that said in the study is the reason they did that was they were worried about safety and they wanted that mixture to be below the flammability limit. And if your mixture isn't flammable, it doesn't seem like just kind of by using basic logic that you're going to have, not get as good of a result. And so, using those numbers that they achieved from that simulated mixture and using, an established efficiency rating and hydrogen output from a commercial electrolyzer, they concluded that it wouldn't work. But then the final sentence of the paper basically says, we may have different results with a real electrolyzer. So,
people familiar with electrolyzers knows is that the byproduct or the product of electrolysis is nothing like tanked hydrogen and oxygen.
Mm-hmm. And so I present those, basically the findings in those simulated papers, and then I show four different studies that are published, and one of them's in the journal called Fuel, another one's International Journal of Hydrogen Energy, and then there's a couple of conference proceedings type papers. One of them is at the time, the electrolysis system, the company was called Earth Systems, and they've gone through several changes, and now the company is currently, they're marketing themselves as Hydrive, and they're a company out of Canada that's publicly traded, and then this paper, which is an early-on system, they ran data on about 30 vehicles, all different sizes, and the average over that wide range of 30 vehicles from engine size of 1.8 liter to 12 liter, averaging all the results from all those vehicles, with extensive data, they found a 20% increase across the board. And that's there's that paper, and then there's a couple other another paper from Turkey using a more basic.
In addition to that, we have major trucking firms are installing that high drive system on their fleets, and they wouldn't be doing that if they weren't achieving results. Right.
Well, right on the HyDrive website, they state that their system has been tested by an independent third party using the FAA test procedures. And so their results that they post on their site are overall average fuel savings of about 10.5%, which, you know, that's low than a lot of the other people are claiming. But, I feel like they're probably trying to be conservative. And
well, another thing is, you know, when you consider how much the fuel bill is on a diesel rig that's constantly driving across the country.
That's very significant.
Yeah. In fact, they even said the unit costs something like $10,000, and the trucking firm representative said that they in the news broadcast interview, which is viewable, I believe, on YouTube, the company representative of the trucking firm said that they can justify that $10,000 cost for a unit being installed on one of their rigs in a matter of months.
Right.
That 10% fuel saving, if that's what it is, actually pays for a $10,000 price tag within a year.
Right.
So for someone to say that this technology doesn't work and this company is installing numerous $10,000 units on their fleet.
Well, and you don't see them being attacked. You know, they're a publicly traded company, and they've been this first paper. You know, they've gone through several iterations of names of their company. So this paper that I have was published in '99, talking about data that was taken as early as 1993.
So here we are, 17 years later, and the FTC is pursuing. Even if you take Dutchman and Dennis Lee and whatever other parties are named in this suit. Take them out of the picture and just say it's the technology itself that's being attacked. The MIT professor is basically saying that the technology is bunk.
Right.
And so how is it that the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing?
You wonder.
Yeah. I mean, there are legitimate frauds out there that deserve to be attacked and pursued, prosecuted. On the other hand, we have all these millions of internal combustion engine vehicles spewing out deadly pollution, and here's a device that has been proven to reduce emissions, even if it doesn't do anything for mileage, if it just cleans up the exhaust stream. And it has been proven to. I've talked to numerous people who've had engine exhaust gas analysis done on a vehicle that has a unit installed, and the results are really quite astounding.
My
with a very
purpose,
small amount of gas.
Right. My whole purpose with being involved in this thing is, you know, I've been researching this technology, and we need more research. You know, I've been able to find four papers where they've actually tested an electrolyzer. I mean, and with the technology you were mentioning that the first patent is like 1918, I mean, you would think that, you know, if there was some studies where they actually tested an electrolyzer, you know, I have stacks of journal papers around here, you know, all discussing hydrogen enrichment. So,
something? It wasn't 1918. It was actually 20 years prior to that, the first patent reference that I've found to boosting with hydrogen.
Right.
And this is actually found in a patent issued to Luther Wattles. And he actually had a couple patents issued to him, including one for an engine specifically designed. He designed an engine to run on hydrogen in the late 1800s. But this patent that I'm looking at right now, it's in my book, and it's entitled System of Generating and Using Hydrogen Gas and Electricity. So he was on the same page as Francisco Pacheco of New Jersey, interestingly, because Dennis Lee's from New Jersey. Francisco Pacheco had a system for generating both hydrogen gas and electricity from a unit. But in the case of this patent, which the number I'm looking at here is number 583,104. That shows how old it is. It's not hasn't even reached half, a little over half a million in the patent number sequence. 583,104. And in this patent, he refers to boosting.
Right.
He says that the use of this gas can allow you to use a less expensive fuel in your engine. And back then, of course, there was no conventional gasoline pump available to people. There was kerosene and other types of fuel, along with gasoline. And I'm looking for the particular line where it refers to this, but it makes reference to the fact that you can use this as a supplement to your fossil fuel, and you can use a lower grade of fuel as a result, a cheaper grade of fuel. So there you have hydrogen boosting in 1897.
Right. Well, I
guess actually
my
goes back.
My main thing is, you know, a lot of assumptions are made in these studies. You know, they assume that hydrogen gas is, you know, just one type of gas. But if you look at the studies by Ruggiero Santilli and a young fellow, Chris Ekman, who's a undergraduate in physics and engineering at Idaho State University, and he actually took a Brown's gas unit and ran the output through a mass spectrometer, and I have the chart from that in my paper here, and there's
many components
in the gas. I mean, it's got several different isotopes of hydrogen, different isotopes of water, components that they're not sure what they are, and monatomic hydrogen and oxygen, which wouldn't be expected to be there at all. So, you know, there just needs to be more research. I mean, for people like myself and Chris, you know, doing these research projects on our own, you know, on our own research, myself, you know, personal funding, you know, trying to scrape together money to do the research. I mean, we just need, you know, if it doesn't work, you know, let's prove it doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know,
and speaking of you know, garage-based research as opposed to university-funded research, people have actually exploded different types of gas that different electrolyzers have produced and have noted a difference in the explosive aspect. I don't know if you've heard that. Perhaps you have too.
Well, you see those things. You know, when I was experimenting with running my scooter off the output of one of my cells, you know, when I had the gas going in there, it would take a certain amount more gas at one point, and then I put a desiccant material in line with the gas, which dried it out, and it may have done some other chemical reactions, I'm not sure. And it would take significantly less gas to idle the engine. So, you know, just that, those basic experiments right there. But it's still very, you know, those type of experiments are still very subjective.
Yeah.
And, you know, having a university lab or, you know, a commercial or whatever we need, you know, the testing needs to be done. I mean,
but when you have academics throwing cold water on the whole idea, saying it's not even worth investigating because
right.
it's bad science, it can't work. They point to the efficiency of the engine, the efficiency electrolyzer, and the BTU content of the gas, and they say it ain't going to work.
We just need to approach this whole thing with the scientific method, you know, and test it. Using the same, you know, if you're going to say an electrolyzer system doesn't work in a vehicle, you know, then you need to get a vehicle, get electrolyzer, you know, the best one you can get, and, you know, have a vehicle that has, you know, either a carburetor or a ECU that you can control, and, you know, test it with the exact same conditions that you're saying doesn't work.
Okay, so here's what's interesting about this case then. The MIT scientist who is being used as an expert witness against Dennis Lee, although he may have a background in internal combustion engines, unlike the first cryogenic scientist they had mistakenly chosen for the first case, by the wording of his testimony, it appears that he, in the same case as the first one, has done no actual experimenting, as you just suggested. He's all speaking about theory and hypothetical situations and not what he himself has proven.
Well, and I have no doubt. He's written many papers, and he's done lots of stuff with bottled hydrogen and fuel reformers and all those things. You know, he's done that. But, you know, we haven't proven that hydrogen is the same as electrolysis products or Brown's gas or HHO, whatever you want to call it. As far as I'm concerned, you know, the electrolysis products coming from a cell that doesn't separate the gases is, you know, it's the same, whether you call it HHO, Brown's gas, whatever you want to call it. But there's something that happens when you have that electrolysis process and all the gases are coming off together and they're able to react or whatever they do.
And this was mentioned by the owner of the company that produced the first water welder in Arizona back in the 60s. William Rhodes was the physicist who was employed to come up with the design of that particular product. But the president of the company was an interview on a guest on this program sometime, I suppose it was over a year ago. And I'm looking at the patent right now. The patent was issued in 1967, patent number 3,310,483. And again, this is on page, let's see here, this is on page 91, 92 of my book. And basically, this is the electrolyzer that Bob Boyce gets credit for. It's a multi-cell oxyhydrogen generator. It's got those plates, like 6x6 stainless steel plates. Actually, in this case, they were steel plates. One side of them was nickel-plated, I suppose. But William A. Rhodes, and it says Phoenix, Arizona, he was the one granted this patent. But he was actually in the employ of Mr. Hennis, Richard Hennis. And Mr. Hennis is not one who really believes in water as a source of fuel. It was obvious by his tone in the interview that he's not making any claims that anything over unity can be done with the gas or anything. But he did make one statement during that interview. He said, "We could not explain the temperature that was able to be achieved with the oxyhydrogen, the common single-ducted gases coming out of an electrolyzer."
I'll give you a perfect example of that. You know, I built myself a little torch, you know, basic plumbing parts and a MIG welder tip, and the cell that I use for running the scooter in some of the videos, same cell. You know, I hooked up that little torch, you know, probably using about 2 liters per minute. And if I take that torch and shine it on the concrete out in the garage, it'll melt the concrete. And I take a propane torch and you put that on the concrete, it doesn't melt the concrete. But conventional wisdom would tell you that, you know, propane has a lot more energy density than hydrogen if you do it on a volume basis. So, that flame will, you know, melt a little hole in the concrete. And, you know, I'm not sure what the melting temperature of concrete is, but that propane torch won't do that.
Yeah, so there are some aspects of the gaseous mixture that comes from water that have not been properly explained, even though accredited scientists like Yul Brown have attempted to study it, and apparently they were still left wondering.
The interesting thing is that, you know, they would attack him. You know, Dennis was telling me that, you know, when the talk, when talk is discussed about Brown's gas, they say, well, that's pseudoscience. So,
yeah,
you
Neil
know,
Brown was a scientist that I greatly respect. I never met him. He died long before I became interested in this technology.
Right.
But based on one article in particular that I read about Mr. Brown was written up in a magazine, an Australian magazine called Electronics Australia.
Uh-huh.
It was sort of a hi-fi and electronics guru type, electronics nerd magazine. And this article was dated from the, I suppose it was the mid-70s. And it was basically a description of Mr. Brown's laboratory and what he was doing there. And it was a fairly knowledgeable writer, someone interested in science, who did the write-up. I have a copy of it. I had it in my museum, the Kentucky Waterfield Museum. I had a copy of the article. And, you know, the guy was a very sincere and really an excellent scientist.
Uh-huh.
And to say that his work was all a sham, you know, to say that someone who has, someone from academia, like Dr. Santilli, someone who has attempted to explain this phenomena of what you can get out of water by an electric arc on the one hand or basic electrolysis or maybe some kind of advanced electrolysis involving frequencies and so on, and to produce a gas that has been described as a soup of ingredients, which the chart in your paper shows.
Right. And the very interesting thing is the young fellow, Chris Ekman, he's actually this summer working on a research project that, interestingly enough, is being conducted at MIT, or at least I don't know exactly where it's being conducted, but it's in some form related to MIT, and they're researching, you know, the Brown's gas, and, you know, looking for using it for, you know, unique new applications, you know.
So in this case, we'd say that the right mitt doesn't know what the left mitt is doing.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to call MIT a mitt.
Right. Well, it's one of the most prestigious universities, you know, there is. And,
yeah.
You know, they obviously, somebody there, you know, believes in it enough to, you know, research it. And, you know, what we don't know. They're just, all I'm asking is, you know, let's do some research.
And, you know,
you
I'm
know.
Still staring at my computer screen. There's a patent drawing of an early engine, because in 1918 engines weren't real, you know, fancy. It just shows a side profile of an engine, the intake manifold, and it's got this electrolyzer, nice little can with tubes sticking out of the top, one for oxygen, one for hydrogen. So he was separating the gases. You could inject both of them, or one of them, or either one. There were valves to shut off either one. So if you decided you want to have oxygen injection instead of hydrogen injection, or both, and it's a very simple device, and claims that this device improves the combustion in an internal combustion engine.
Right. Well, you would think it would have been done by now, but, you know, I'm looking for, I would like to do a PhD research on this in some form. You know, I hope I get the opportunity to do that someday. Because it's really, I'm in it for just the knowledge and, you know, proving things. Not really, you know, about money or anything else for me.
Yeah, well, I think it's really good that you've been called in on this case, because you're one of the few academics in the United States that's openly admitting that you're interested in the technology, that you've already done enough experiments to know that there's something there worth pursuing, and you want to continue your research.
Well, and even if it's not, you know, if we do the research, I don't believe that would be the case, but, you know, we do the research and we prove it wrong, then, you know, we'll save a lot of things, but, you know, we need to at least do it, you know, instead of just saying it doesn't work and using some kind of a, you know, assumptions and theories to, you know, prove it doesn't work. Let's like yeah. Exactly.
But you know, you've done well in calling attention to the research that's already been done. You've managed right. to use your university library access to find papers. You have a total now of what, 7 or 8 papers you found, or more?
Directly related to electrolyzers in some form. Yeah, I have. There's 4 or 5 papers where they're doing stuff with engines using electrolyzer in some form. And then there's several papers more relating to the properties of the brown gas. So there's kind of 2 facets to this thing. There's what it does in engines, and then there's like what does it do like in a torch type application. And so that really you got to understand the properties of the gas really before you apply it to an engine. So I would propose that, you know, we need to find out, you know, how much energy content there is, you know, and what kind of weird reactions are going on that causes, you know, that little tiny flame to melt something like concrete or, you know, higher melting temperature metals or other substances. You know, we need to find out all those things. Then you can use a number to say, okay, we're going to use this energy equivalent of, you know, ground gas. You know, we gotta find out what that reaction is. So.
Yeah. Now here I'm looking at the website for Ron Motors. Ron Motors being the Texas automaker that's really, I guess, the first automaker in the world to put a hydrogen booster under the hood. And they have what's called the H2GO system. And they're actually offering this as a standalone aftermarket unit that you can purchase and install on your vehicle.
It's just very difficult to do, you know, do it in aftermarket. You really need the, you know, a car company involved on it in some form. Because, you can't expect you're adding a totally different type of component to the fuel light. You know, I don't believe that in the application of using it, how we're talking about, you know, supplementing a small amount into the engine, you're not adding a fuel. You're adding some kind of a, not really a catalyst. That's not quite the right word, but it's something, a component that enhances the, you know, hydrocarbon fuel in some way. So you really need to retune some, you know, you can't expect, okay, we're just going to throw it in there and use the same operating conditions as gasoline or diesel and expect it, you know, to get these great improvements, you know. And to have that work consistently, you really need to have it tuned from the factory.
Well, that also begs the question, why haven't automobiles been optimized from the factory? When we talk about flex fuel vehicles, for example, we're still talking about hydrocarbon fuel vehicles.
For the E85 vehicles, I think they have some kind of a sensor in the fuel tank that measures, you know, the content of the ethanol, and that adjusts the map. So, you know, we need some way to sense that, oh, well, we're putting electrolysis gas in there. And, you know, we need to do this or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, doesn't it seem that that this could have been done? That we could have all along now, because it's been so long, it's been decades, that the automakers could have been optimizing engines to accept the products of electrolysis under the hood.
I believe it's really based on, you know, when fuel prices are high, you know, companies and people are very interested in this type of technology. And then when the fuel prices drop, then the interest goes down quite a bit. So it's really, you know, now the fuel prices right now, I'm not sure how the interest is as far as, you know, people, but it's definitely not what it was in, you know, the summer of 2008 or so, when fuel was $4 a gallon or whatever. So a lot of it is based on just, you know, motivation. You know, if it's really hitting a company or an individual's pocketbook to have expensive fuel, then they're more interested in, you know, things to save it. But when the fuel, gasoline or whatever, it's not worth it to invest in, you know, a technology that would be potentially expensive to implement.
Yeah. Well, they have posted on their website at Ron Motors the dyno results, the smog test results, and it's pretty impressive. Significant reduction in hydrocarbons. I'm looking at one for a Lincoln Navigator, 2002 Lincoln Navigator. It says that the hydrocarbon reduction was 48.44%.
Right. No, that's very significant.
Yeah, those are numbers that should be on everybody's mind, because anyone who drives is responsible for the pollution that's coming out their tailpipe. And if a simple device that could be adapted to all of our vehicles could reduce the pollution from our tailpipes, and it does represent an initial upfront cost, but beyond that, if there are fuel savings that can actually offset that investment over a
right.
not too long a term, then why not use it? Why should there be a federal case against it?
Right, exactly. And especially when, you know, there's other companies who are doing a similar thing, you know, who have gone, you know, maybe done more the established testing to show that it's valid, you know.
Well, I will say this.
I don't want them to get in trouble, but, you know, it just needs to be investigated. We need, you know, if they were to present data where it was actually tested, then, you know, it might be a little bit easier to, you know, accept that it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But
in fact, I know that in other...
presenting that data, then it's kind of hard.
Mm-hmm. It would seem that other manufacturers would almost want to come to Dennis Lee's side in this case. Because the smear campaign against hydrogen boosting really applies to all them as well.
Right.
It's not that the HAFC was a defective unit. It was producing gas fairly efficiently for a dry cell.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't a terrible unit. So if the government
is
saying
difficult.
That...
It's difficult when you're trying to apply an aftermarket technology to, you know, a wide range of different vehicles and different conditions. And, you know, in just my own experimentation, you know, if you're using a cell that's still kind of in the prototype stage, you know, just maintenance on the system could make you not get a gain.
Yeah.
You know,
something... I would have to say that if there's one thing that Dennis Lee and Dutchman did wrong, it was that they were premature in releasing the product in view of what you just said. The fact that all these vehicles with all their computers, all these computers seem hell-bent on not allowing for any gains. The default setting is to waste fuel, not to save it.
Mm-hmm.
And any attempt made to lean out the mixture is only going to cause the injectors to dump more fuel.
Right.
So,
well, and that's what some of these other companies, like Ron Motors, they decide, well, we'll make our own vehicle. And Hydrive, they've decided to focus on one specific type of engine. I think they're focusing on a Caterpillar engine. They're like, well, we can figure out how to do this one engine.
So there's where the wisdom comes in. In other words, Ron Motors, although I made the comment a few minutes ago that they're marketing this H2GO system for aftermarket, the fact is that they've shown restraint in doing that. They made it sound like the release was imminent, and they even mentioned a partnership, I believe, with AMCO transmission shops to do the installations throughout North America. But
right.
Isn't it interesting that we haven't heard anything about that now, and it's going on, well, it's well over a year. So
well, here's the issue.
I'm sorry?
In order to do this right, we need to have all the EPA testing. We need to have, you know, we need to have SAE testing. We need to have all these testing is going through the proper channels, so it's accepted, and so that it, you know, it works. If we show it works to those testing, you know, it works. The problem is those testing are very expensive, and it's difficult to get, you know, investment in this technology because of the bad press, you know, stuff like this.
Yeah. But, you know, I did an interview a couple nights ago with Julio and Ephraim from Green Gas LLC. And they're showing such restraint in the release of their product.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, they've basically given away about 200 boosters to friends and acquaintances to put on their vehicles and to verify that gains are possible with those vehicles. And they admitted in this interview, although it's done in Spanish, so you may not have been able to understand it, but they admitted that there are some vehicles that will not accept hydrogen boosting.
Right.
It is impossible to see gains from it.
Mm-hmm.
And that has more to do, as we were discussing, with a computer and the way it's designed to reject such efforts.
I believe there are certain parameters. I think different vehicles base their, it's all based on, you know, what is considered safe emissions. You know, you need to have a certain type of running condition for the catalytic converter to work correctly. And different vehicles use different types of input signals to govern that. And so you might have one vehicle that bases it on one thing that is less affected by the injection of the electrolysis gas than others. And so, you know, I think it's probably fairly manufacturer dependent and probably age dependent.
Yeah, so on the one hand, we have these wonderful cars that are fairly trouble-free, and the ECU has been largely responsible for us not having to get under the hood and change the points and so on, like we used to have to do so often on the older cars, constantly fiddling with them, you know?
Right, and we need to have the hydrogen system, electrolysis system, based, you know, needs to be controlled by the ECU. You say, you know, it needs to have the maps for the output of the electrolysis cell, based, you know, controlled by the ECU, and have it all working together.
And it's capable of doing it. I mean, look at how many sensors they've added to the basic car computer over the years. Seems
right.
Like every year they're coming out with another sensor to add to the block, you know, or to the coolant temperature or whatever, the exhaust temperature. You know, they're monitoring more stuff now than ever. I mean, they've even talked about having a breathalyzer in the cab so that if the driver is drunk, the ECU will shut the whole thing down.
Or they have, you know, things that will adjust your radio based on the sound in the car, and or the whole OnStar thing where they can shut your car off, or, you know,
exactly.
Do your car from a satellite somewhere or something.
So it's not that great of a challenge, as Bill Lang puts it, to add another layer to the multiple layers that have already been laid down on a basic car.
The problem is the background research hasn't been done to know the parameters.
Or if it has been done, it's been done by individuals who haven't wanted to bring it to the fore because of the implications it has on the current energy paradigm.
Right. Well,
and
a
that's
lot
more
of it,
likely
you know,
the case.
You have those aspects, and then you have, you know, some of the people who are doing the experiments. You know, they're doing tweaking stuff, you know, and, you know, kind of in the backyard type thing. And, you know, they find something that works, and they go with it. And they don't worry so much, you know, they don't have the ability and funding to do that. I mean, I've just found, you know, just to do some simple experiments to do data, I mean, it just costs a lot of money. R&D is very expensive, and to actually prove your R&D is even more expensive.
Yeah,
so,
that's true.
That's really what it runs into. And a lot of the companies who are, you know, trying to get this technology started, they're trying to do it on a very shoestring budget, and you end up having to put your prototype units out as commercial just to keep going.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the problem that happened with Dutchman is, you know, you've got itchy feet to try to get a return on your investment and to actually start generating income so that you can improve the product.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, that's fraught with difficulties because of the complexity of modern vehicles.
I've heard numbers that for a, an automobile manufacturer to develop a new technology on a car, it would cost probably an average of about $5 billion. So you figure, you know, we're trying to do this stuff on, you know, in the tens of thousands or less, you know, with some small company, and, you know, when to do it right for the big boy would cost, you know, many times that.
Yeah. Speaking of which, you made reference earlier today to a video that you saw that was actually filmed at a Ford factory location. Is that correct?
It was actually a meeting hall of members of a hydrogen company, installers, and somebody high up in Ford was interested in testing that, and so they were testing it in 2008, and they were finding positive results. And then
you mentioned the number of vehicles they had it installed on.
I think it was something like 30. I don't know if it was vehicles. I think it was dynoed engines or something like that.
Okay, 30 different engines.
And they were seeing positive results, and the interest was high when fuel prices were high, and then, you know, the interest left when the fuel prices dropped.
So you're saying that in late 2008, fuel prices dropped dramatically?
Right, right. It's pretty well documented.
And
I think
so,
the price went from $4 a gallon to, you know, $2 a gallon. Or
describe
less.
The video then. It was a group of Ford technicians?
It was a gentleman high up in Ford, and the audience was a group of installers of a hydrogen system, and he was speaking about the testing and about the future relations, and then the video ended like it was going to, you know, just take off, and it was going to, you know, be implemented within that year, potentially. And, well, it's not implemented, so whatever happened, we can only speculate.
You know, I mentioned having sat in on a meeting at Middle Tennessee State University back in 2007, I believe it was, possibly 2008. And at this meeting, Bill Ford was quoted as having said that he would give $1 million to a research team such as the team there at Middle Tennessee State University if they could produce a vehicle that would go from coast to coast on a tank of fuel.
Right.
What I thought was interesting is he said it cannot be an electric vehicle. So did that imply that he knew that such electric vehicles existed, that they were doable? And that he was looking for something to be used in internal combustion engines such as we already have.
Huh.
At any rate, that was the challenge that he offered this group of people at that university. I don't know how many other groups around the country heard such an offer, but I have no reason to doubt that the professor that mentioned this and the group of men that were sitting around the table with me, they weren't inventing this story. They weren't exaggerating it. Supposedly, this was a direct offer that came from the president of Ford at that time.
Huh. Interesting. What year was that?
That was after I closed the museum. I closed the museum in the fall of 2006, and it was it could have been as early as that winter, 2006, 2007, or on into the year, possibly as late as 2008. I can't recall exactly when it was.
In that period of time, we were, you know, in the higher fuel crisis era, which I think we're, you know, fuel here is $3 a gallon, so, you know, we're that's not a very good price still.
So speaking of here, why don't we wrap this up by talking about the deposition you're to give? You're living in Washington State now, neighbor to Idaho, where you're from, right?
Right. I'm living in Kennewick, Washington, and I'm working as a mechanical engineer in Richland, Washington.
And you've been asked to go to Yakima, correct?
Right.
To give a deposition to a U.S. attorney there, is that correct?
It's I believe it'll be attorneys from the Federal Trade Commission, and I imagine there'll be a representative from Dutchman in some form. I don't know if it'll be a teleconference or if they'll actually come. I don't know all the details on that.
So if they come, they're coming from Washington, D.C., flying across the country to Washington.
Yeah, I know for sure that the people from the Federal Trade Commission are coming from Washington, D.C.
And they will be asking you questions, and you'll be giving them answers based on your research.
That's how I understand it, yeah.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear that they recognize your time spent in this field as qualifying you to make a comment about the veracity of this technology.
Right.
Well, thank you for sharing this information with our audience. It's something that if anyone wants to contact you and contribute to this pool of information, they can do so by emailing you, correct?
Yeah, IdahoHydrogen@yahoo.com. And I've also put together a website, IdahoHydrogen.com.
Okay,
and I'll be working on, I'd like to get this expert witness paper that I authored. I'd like to get that up there on that site. Probably be sometime this weekend. I'd like to get it up there. So,
that'd be great. I'm sure people will be very interested in seeing that gas. Was it a gas chromatograph analysis? Is that what that was?
The Santilli, I don't actually have Santilli's graphs in the paper. Santilli did a bunch of gas chromatographs. This actual graph was from Chris Ekman, and it was with a mass spectrometer.
Mass spectrometer, yes. And that's
a
very
chemist,
fascinating.
I'm not a chemist, so I don't know exactly how that works, but it's able to detect different masses of elements and molecules in a gas and gives you a chart of those different elements. And then you
just a cursory glance at the chart reveals that the gases coming from water are not simple, H2O.
There's a wide array of components. Basically, it gives you the mass of the element and the amount, and then you look up on the periodic table to determine the, what element it may be. So that's basically what was done. It's not, most universities, labs, have these pieces of equipment. So this data, could very easily be replicated.
Yeah. And wouldn't it be interesting to see differences in the composition of the gases based on the exact kind of electrolyzer that was used, the exact electrolyte, the water that was used in that electrolyte?
Yeah, I believe that there's definitely, we could find the optimized gas by doing that.
For an accredited scientist to say that tanked hydrogen and oxygen will produce the same result in an internal combustion engine as electrolytic gas is quite preposterous, based just on a cursory glance at that chart.
Well, you look at the chart, it's definitely different than, basic diatomic hydrogen. That's definitely a part of it, but there's other components in there too. And, shouldn't be too difficult to get more data like that. So, definitely a scientist.
Thank you for your hard work, and thank you for joining us this evening. I'll let you return to your family, and anyone who wants to contact you can go to your website, IdahoHydrogen.com, or the contact email again was
IdahoHydrogen@yahoo.com.
Very good. Okay. Well, take care. We'll look forward to hearing more about this case.
All right. Thank you.
Good night.